I'm sorry, folks. I had a little glitch there in my phone when I was calling in. Anyway, tonight, Phil Donnelly, who was my guest last February, who just is a terrific writer and is published by Ocean V Publishing, is with me to speak to his very special guest, T.J. Turner. Phil's latest book is called Seconds to Midnight. He is a very fine, award-winning, and best-selling author. It is my pleasure to introduce your host for tonight, Phil Donnelly. Phil, take it away.
Bam, thanks so much. I can't thank you enough for this opportunity. I've been excited about it since we first discussed this in February.
Have fun with it. Bye-bye.
Oh, I will. My guest pick tonight is a friend of mine and a fellow Ocean View author, T.J. Turner. T.J., thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks, Phil. I appreciate it. Thanks for asking me. And thanks, Pam. Thanks for having us.
So I first met T.J. in a bar in San Diego. We all know the root word of publishing is pub, so that's an appropriate story. And he told me about himself, and it was his introduction reads like any three bright, successful people I've met. He's a research scientist with a PhD from Cornell, and you're a federal agent with the Air Force. I've seen your badge. I'm assuming you carry a gun, and you're a novelist.
Yep.
That's fairly epic. You and your wife Nancy have three children, and you live in Ohio. And how in the world do you find time to write?
It can be a challenge, that's for certain. So, but balancing all the different things that come up, especially with the family and the jobs and things, it can be hard. It's mostly I just don't sleep. So,
well,
late at night when the house is quiet is when I usually get most of my writing done, and then sometimes early in the morning too.
Okay. Well, the writing you've done is significant because your first book, Lincoln's Bodyguard, was tremendous. You hooked me on that first night I met you, and you gave me the elevator speech for that book, and I'm just like, no way! It's like that's amazing. So, I contacted your agent, who I know, and asked for an arc ahead of publication, and you sent me the arc, which I thought was funny. And you wrote something inside the arc for me. Do you remember what that was?
I don't remember exactly, no.
It says that this was the very first book you've signed. So
yeah, that's right.
I have the very first book that that T.J. Turner has signed as a published author. So is it worth $1 million yet?
That's a good question. Probably not yet, but let's maybe someday.
Okay. Well, I'm stoked.
Here's hoping,
because,
right?
Yeah, Lincoln's Bodyguard was great, and then your second book, Land of Wolves, and I was excited about that. And so I went straight to the publisher and was able to get an early typeset copy. And you know what? It's as writers, we kind of, we take 10 years or whatever to write the first book, and then we finally get published, and then someone taps us on the shoulder and says, hey, can you write the second one and turn it in about 8 months?
Yep.
So a lot of times the second one doesn't have the zing the first one did, but you knocked this one out of the park, I got to say. I was impressed.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it. Yeah, that's pretty much exactly how it happened. They turned around and said, hey, how about a deadline of this? And I don't think it was quite 8 months. I think I may have had 11 or 12 months. But yeah, it was tight, but it flowed really well for me. So it felt good writing.
Well, it did. And I have to ask you, I mean, I write thrillers, but you write these historical thrillers, historical fiction thrillers, I guess is what you'd say. And that, to me, that's hard. That's got to be hard. You have to take your characters and you have to, which are great, by the way, and then you have to make them compelling, and then you have to make them do stuff that'll keep people turning the pages, and you have to do it within the framework of history. That's
sure.
It's real.
Yep.
So when I write, I have trouble lining up time zones. how much research do you have to do to pull this off? Or are you such a historian that you can do this with minimal effort?
No, I definitely have a lot of research goes into each one. And I'm glad you phrased it the way you did, because I have friends who write fantasy and they write other genres, and they always look at me and I always feel like I'm cheating because I'm writing historical fiction, so my world is already built for me, right? So I kind of look at it like that. Like, I've got the backdrop, I kind of got the constraints that are already there that I know I need to fit into. So I've got these friends who build whole worlds from scratch, and they've got to put that all into their backstory and get it into their characters and everything that goes on in their story development. So I guess some people consider it hard, you know, writing is in terms of history being constrained by it. Other people would call it cheating because it's already there for you. So I guess you could look at it both ways, right?
I think
it works both ways.
From my standpoint, it looks hard, but you make it look easy. It's easy just to make stuff up. Apparently, that's what my writer friends tell me. It's like, well, you take your background. You know, my background's aviation, and it's like you take your background, you know, stuff you're an expert at, and then you make stuff up. How hard can that be, Donnelly? And it's not easy all the time, but. Yeah, but you've got stuff built in that you have to work around, and I think you do a nice job with that. I grew up liking Westerns, and so and while your books aren't Westerns per se at all, but
right.
Historically it's happening at the same time that westward expansion is happening, especially the newest book, Land of Wolves, but it's and I really appreciated that, and I really liked the Native American aspect of that. So is that something we're going to see more of, or are you going to venture off in different areas of history from here on out?
Well, it's a good question. So Lincoln's Bodyguard started with that premise of what would America look like if our greatest president had lived, right? So it's historical fiction. It's alternative historical, and it takes the standpoint from April 14th, 1865 on out. I can kind of change history a little bit. So where I still have history that I got to fit into, so that we all kind of know it doesn't look totally unrealistic. I've also cheated a little bit myself in that I've allowed myself to modify history enough so that I've got some leeway with the story. On the whole Western and the Native American front. That's really tied in with the main character. So Joseph Foster is half Native American, and his heritage becomes a real much bigger part in that second book. And a lot of that was inspired from a trip I took out west with my family 2 summers ago. So driving out west, I had already started percolating the idea of what a sequel would look like to Lincoln's Bodyguard, and then seeing South Dakota, seeing the Lakota territories, just was really inspiring. So that all brought together for Land of Wolves. And then the next book in the series that I'm working on right now is actually going to be a prequel. So it's going to predate Lincoln's Bodyguard, and it's going to be the story of the female protagonist and where she comes from. So you won't see as much on the Native American front, but instead you're going to kind of switch and see some of the southern and the build southern states and the build up to war as the Civil War starts to break out. So it's still in that same broad genre, but it's sort of looking at different aspects that are happening around the same time period.
Interesting. So, and I'm not a historian at all, and I'm the first to admit that. But when I read your books, I feel like I'm being educated a little bit. Is that accurate? Can I say that? Have I learned something?
I guess so. So I've always been a student of American history. And when I started writing, I wrote science fiction to start with. And I don't know why it took me so long to come to writing historical fiction. It's almost like it landed on me as opposed to me selecting it, right? The story of Lincoln's Bodyguard came to me, and that was what inspired me to write the whole novel. And then I realized that I really liked weaving in actual historical events. And as you alluded to earlier, it does take quite a bit of research. So I spend my whole first part of my writing process is really digging through kind of as much historical accounts as I can find, and looking for those neat little historical threads that are in there that you could kind of build and put into a story. So I like it to be educational as it could be. And at the very end, I try to include an author's notes where I talk about which books influenced me, which ones I looked at for research. And if I inspired somebody to maybe to go through that part of my author's notes and look at the books that I used and pick up one of them and learn something, that would be amazing, right? That would be whatever your author would strive for. You've helped inspire somebody to go look and learn something new about a topic you may not have known about. And we can do that through fiction. I think that's all the better.
Yeah, mission accomplished, because with me, I'm out west and I'm traveling around, and I spend time in Montana and Wyoming, and I'm kind of a gypsy, but your book stayed with me for a long time, and I would hear things and I'd see things, and I'm like, why does that sound familiar? And then I would realize it was from your book, and then out comes the phone, and I have to ask Google a question. So
that's great.
You know, it wasn't a read and forget book, and neither one of your books are that way, and so job well done, I have to say.
I appreciate it.
So, you know, most writers, when I meet them and talk to them, it kind of becomes apparent that, you know, they write what they know, and you don't fit that mold, because you're a scientist, you're a special agent, and the stuff you seem to maybe know about wouldn't have existed as much in 1865. So how did you end up writing historical alternative fiction?
Yeah, absolutely. So, like I said, I started off writing science fiction and writing other things. I actually did write a novel that's, you know, it's in the bottom shelf of my desk. It's about Afghanistan, so it came after my first deployment overseas. So I was inspired to write something about what I had seen there. But it was almost like that book was too fresh. The conflict was still going on. It still is going on. And I just couldn't quite find anybody to pick it up and be interested in looking at it. And so it really was one of the books that taught me that I could write a whole book. And I had been working on that one pretty regularly. I had just actually gotten off a phone call with a freelance editor who had gone through it and looked at it for me. I had met him at the ENIAC Writers Workshop, and he had agreed to take a look at it. And his advice to me was to put the book down and let it sit and come back to it in like a year and start writing my next project. So I was actually driving home, and I was kind of actually depressed after that conversation. I was like, wow, you know, I've spent so much time on this one book. It didn't get anywhere. How do I pick my next project, and what do I want to write? And the radio was on, and it was Fresh Air was on, and Terry Gross was talking with somebody, and I don't even know exactly what the topic of conversation was that they had going, but they were talking about presidential assassinations or something of that measure. And they started talking about Lincoln, and Terry Gross said, wouldn't it have been a very different world if Lincoln had had a real bodyguard that night? Of course, he had a bodyguard that was obviously not very, very good bodyguard.
But that
really stuck in my mind. And I said, wow, Lincoln's bodyguard, that what a incredible name for a book. And by the time I got home, about 20 minutes later, I had the beginning part of this thing mapped out in my head, and I started writing a few weeks later after doing some digging and some research. And all of a sudden, my love for American history and the books that I read kind of just merged with my writing, and it took off from there. I finished that first book in about 10 months on a very first draft, and it felt magical, I guess, as you're sitting down and writing. And so I kind of knew that there was something special to this project that I was working on. You know, and getting it published as the first book out of the gate for me is, confirms that suspicion, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you know, the part I've always maintained is you can write what you know about, because that's the easiest, but you're going to have the most fun if you write what you're passionate about. And I think that shows in the books too. So
absolutely.
So let's talk about, there are two schools of thought I've kind of discovered in just idle chat with different writers. There are writers that swear up and down by writers groups, and there are writers that run as fast as they can away from writers groups. You have, I think had some really, really good success with writers' workshops. And can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So the Antioch Writers' Workshop is really, and in full disclosure, I'm the president of the Board of Trustees, although I'm on a hiatus because I was deployed this past year and just getting home. But it was the place that really taught me what it is to be a writer and the fact that I was a writer. I kind of came to it tentatively, as we all do. We've all got, like, I had a manuscript at the time, and I didn't really know what to do with it. I didn't know what agents were. I didn't know what, you know, how the whole publishing game worked. My wife is the one who kind of pushed me in that direction. So she's the one who found out that the Antioch Writers Workshop actually takes place in the town that I live in Ohio, and, you know, encouraged me to apply. And I got one of the scholarships and was able to attend the very first year free of charge. So they have these scholarships every year. So anyone's interested in writing, it's a great place to go. And it turned out to be just a really supportive community. It was a lot more about the craft. They weren't really worried about the commercial aspect and the pitching. It was what I needed, especially at the beginning stages. And from there, I started learning more. I got introduced to published authors and then could pick their brains and find out about the whole publishing business. And so it was just a fantastic place for me to start. It was a great nurturing environment. And so I still stayed with it. I was a work fellow for them for several years, and then they asked me to be on the board because I like to, you know, help see the workshop continue to grow and offer programs for people to, you know, to find their own way in the writing life, just as I was given the opportunity. But so that was a great experience for me. But I don't have any outside writing group per se, other than, you know, my connections at the workshop.
So how many people read your manuscript before you send it to your agent? And we'll talk about your agent here in a minute.
Sure. Let's see. On the first one, so for Lincoln's Bodyguard, certainly I let my wife read it, and she's one of my biggest critiques. So, you know, they always tell you need to find someone who doesn't love you to read your manuscript to get honest feedback. I'm lucky enough to have someone
exactly
who loves
right.
me and who still gives me very honest feedback.
That's good for you.
So she'll tell me when things don't ring true, and she's very brutal about it. I now have a 12-year-old daughter who also does the same thing. She can tell me where things just aren't believable. She'll just shake her hot head and roll her eyes and be like, "This part, Daddy, just, you know, you need to redo this part." And she's a voracious reader as well. But then besides that, I had three or four close friends that read through and were able to give me some feedback. And then my wife has a book club that she goes to. And it's all just local folks who are friends of hers, and they get together once a month, and she offered to see if they would be willing to read the manuscript for me, and they all said yes, and so they read it, and we had a sit-down. It was the most awkward feeling in the world because I'm the one in the center of the room, and they're actually talking to me, and I've never done a book club before. but it was great. They gave me some really great feedback over it, and kind of put out a few spots. Didn't ring true for them, so allowed me to tune and tighten the story a bit. And then that's the point where I finally got it to, in front of Liz, my agent. And then Liz took a red pen out and hatchet marks and then went to town. It was great. Part of the
problem. Excuse me, gents. I want to go ahead and I want to make an announcement. If you'd like to speak to Philip Dunley or TJ Turner, we're going to open up the switchboard now. You can call in at 347-633-9609. That's 347-633-9609. And the first caller, I'm going to gift a copy of Phil Donnelly's book. Thanks, guys. Sorry to interrupt. Bye.
Thanks. So you touched on something a little bit ago that I want to get back to, and that, you know, I think everybody that's trying to write or that has dreams of writing and being published, I would urge everyone to at some point try to make it a point to talk to a published author. I mean, because mm-hmm. I think that holds true with any profession. If you want to be a pilot, you need to go out and talk to professional pilots. If you want to be an engineer, you should go talk to engineers. You should leap forward and find someone that's traveled that route and pick their brain. And writers are far more accessible than maybe we appear to be, But go to book signings and shake writers' hands and ask them a question or two. And you know, there's I found that it's a pretty approachable group, and we do like to help. And it sounds like you did that, which is awesome. So back to your agent, Liz.
Yep.
I was reading through your bio and I had to smile because it was in the 90s when I went through the agent gyrations and we didn't have the internet, so I would do it all by mail and I'd type out these letters and I would put stamps on them and I'd send them out to agents that I had out of this book, and you'd sit and wait, and you know, I'd wait
Absolutely.
By the mailbox every day, and it was just agonizing. And I finally was fortunate enough to connect with Kimberly Cameron. And this was back in the, I think I have correspondence between her and I from like 1998, 99 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But she asked for the first 50 pages, which is normal, or the first three paragraphs, I think. And then she wanted to see the whole thing. And then we signed. And so then it's been that whole process has changed considerably. And so Liz, who actually works with Kimberly, which is how we all have come to know each other, but for you finding an agent, the process changed. How many did you query? How many agents do you think saw your name?
Sure. So it was actually it was a process of learning, right? My very first time at the Antioch Writers Workshop, I got to meet my first agent, right? And I got kicked into the room. They said, pitch your work. And I didn't even know what a pitch was. And the funny thing was, I was so green, I didn't even know that I was supposed to be nervous walking into this room, right? So we just had this great conversation, and she said, yeah, send me the first 50 pages. And quite honestly, you know, I think there were a lot of people there that, you know, she would say this, and this isn't Liz, this was another agent, you know, send 50 pages, and, you know, very dutifully, about 4 or 5 months later, I got a rejection letter, and I had only just, you know, sent my very first manuscript, that one about Afghanistan, to just that one agent, and just waited patiently every day by the mailbox, right? And then after that, I started learning the process, and I probably, you know, shotgunned way too many. So there's probably about 100 agents out there that got that first manuscript. Liz, if she's listening to this, she's going to hate me because I still haven't given her that manuscript. I promised her I would give it to her one day, but I think I still need some improvement before I give it to her with all I've learned along the way. But, you know, I started getting rejection letters in, and you know, some of them were nice and handwritten or early signed at the bottom. And so I would take that as a success that someone, an actual person had done it. Some were like a half sheet of paper that was like mimeographed out and stamped and mailed back to you.
I know.
You know, and so I did get a bite once from an agent on that first book, and it was exciting to go through that process. But I realized that I had really kind of overshot, right? I had kind of blanketed and didn't really do my research. And the more I learned and talking to other authors about how they got their agent and how focused they had been, you know, the light bulb went off, and I said, okay, this is what I need to do. So I did as much research as I could on the internet, and I looked, you know, who might really fit this genre and be interested in something like this. And I came down to a list of maybe 5 agents. It was 4 or 5.
Oh, wow.
It was people that were very specific. And so for Lincoln's Bodyguard, after it was written and the first manuscript it was done, I said, well, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be very methodical about it this time. I'm going to be more more focused with each of these folks. So I knew what work they had represented in the past and related my work to theirs, you know, the things that they had repped before, and wrote a letter to each of them. And one by one, I got the first 3, and then the 4th rejection letter came in, and then I got a notice I was deploying. So I figured, well, that's good with me. I'll just wait till I get back from this deployment. This was in 2012, and I'll repitch this book because I really believe in this project. It wrote itself too easy. I love the story idea. I hadn't seen anything else like it before, so I thought it had legs. And while I was deployed, I got this email from Liz, and she said, hey, could you send me, because in her submission process, you just gave her a synopsis and a letter. And she said, can you send me the first 50 pages? And I was like, yeah, that's no problems. And so I did it, sent it off, emailed it, and got back to work. Didn't think a thing of it. I was a little excited, but, you know, figured not gonna hold my breath on it. And about a month later, I got another email from her. She's like, can you send me the next 100 pages? And I was like, well, this is a great sign. This is something's happened here. So I send her the next 100 pages. And then I get this email about a week later, and she's like, I think we need to talk. And I was like, oh, God, this is great, but I'm in Afghanistan. Right? So I had to write this email telling her, well, I'm in Afghanistan, so I can call you, but you're not going to be able to call me. I don't even know. I got to ask her someday if she actually believed I was in Afghanistan or not. But she agreed. She gave me her phone number. Most awkward way I've ever asked a girl for a phone number. But I got her phone number, gave her a call. And of course, the time that she was free was like right during the window that we almost always got rocketed. So I'm like, oh, the alarms are going to go off. I'm going to have to hang up on her. So I start the conversation off by telling her that I may have to run really fast. If you hear all these alarms in the background, it's going to be okay. I'll call you back. Like, there's just no way I'm going to land an agent like this. But I may as well go through the experience of the interview and talk to her. And we had a great conversation.
Best way possible. I think it's the best way possible to land an agent. You've got her full attention. Absolutely.
Well, that is if she truly believes I'm in Afghanistan, right? And luckily, no rockets fell that night. I'm of course, in this bay-like area. And, all my coworkers are sitting there looking at me. They had no idea I've written a novel. And I'm trying to talk to someone and describe the novel to them. And I'm getting all these, like, strange looks from these guys around me. It's a pretty comical situation overall. But at the end of the conversation, Liz had really – she had gone through the whole manuscript and had all these great changes. And I must have scribbled 10 or 15 pages of notes. I think she had just great suggestions for the manuscript. And – And at the end of it, she's like, so I'm going to sign you because if I don't, I've given you all these great suggestions and I don't want you to take it to somebody else later on. So she sent me a contract through the mail and it got to me in Afghanistan. So there's this picture of me holding my rifle. I'm sitting in my hallway with my big beard on and holding my very first contract with Liz. So.
That's a great story. That is a great story.
I guess it's probably a long way to answer what you asked for. Is that the first book I was way too over-focused or under-focused and just had maybe 100 agents out there. And then I learned the business a bit better and took my time on the Lincoln's Bodyguard, and it definitely paid dividends.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So how long did it take, Liz, to make the deal with Oceanview, your current publisher?
Oh, that's a great question. So she signed me in February of 2013, and I'm fairly certain it was December 2013 that we had the deal with Oceanview.
Oh, wow.
Which is great. And Liz and I went through a bunch of iterations. I think she was getting sick of me at the end, but she really, really helped my writing style too, just in how she was focusing the revision. So, you know, she's a dear friend. She's phenomenal and just really cut to the chase with the manuscript. So I think that helped it a lot, and I was able to get those changes made, and then that's what got it in front of Oceanview.
Well, that's usually the first the eureka moment with at least with me in my career was when I finally got what I was writing in front of someone who knew how to look at it with an eye toward publication. It's a completely different creature than
it is,
than
absolutely.
Writers groups or anybody else. And so some of the best advice I ever got was, and that's what turned the corner. And so I tell everyone that I know that's working on their novels out there, it's like, do what you can to get it in front of somebody. I mean, even if do your research and do your due diligence, but even if you pay somebody that is
yep.
knowledgeable in that regard, it's money well spent because you can't. There's a lot of things you just cannot excel at on your own. I think I look at. I used to play golf, and I look at golfers, and they have an entourage of people who watch every move they make and tweak stuff all the time. And I sometimes
sure.
sometimes equate that to writers, and we need that. We're going to go out there and we can stand the pressure of playing in a tournament, But other people have to watch the details because we can't focus, we can't spin all those plates at once. And agents
Absolutely.
Are great at that. And so that's so good move on that. So Ocean View comes along and they buy your book, and as they do, they politely ask for another one. At some point in there, was there ever this like oh shit moment where you realized that you were now a professional novelist with a deadline?
Yeah, I think it was when the contract showed up on my door, and I was like, wow, there's a date. There's a real date on this thing right here. And I was like, I got to get going. You know, I had the idea already kind of percolated through it. I had started writing a few chapters, and I had shown those to Liz to see what she thought as a viable option as a sequel. And that's where she took it right to Ocean View. And, you know, that was the next thing I heard is, hey, yeah, they would definitely like to see more. And so, you know, getting that contract from Ocean View for the second novel was, you know, was definitely that moment, right? And there was pressure. Is, you know, I had been able to write Lincoln's Bodyguard in a fairly short period of time, but then there was a long period of time with the revisions,
right.
and a lot of help from Liz and from others. But particularly with Liz, you know, she had this great way of helping me really hone the story. And I was worried that would be the process again, all over again, and that would be beyond the deadline that Ocean View would give
right.
me. And you know, so there was definitely some pressure there. And when I was able to do it, that was exciting. So I think finishing that second novel and feeling pretty good about it when I finished the first draft of it, that was the second moment where I was like, wow. Okay, so not only did I get the pressure of having this contract and a deadline, but I was able to pull it off, and that was a pretty cool feeling.
Well, that is. I mean, there was. I remember when I was in that position, and it's like, oh crap, I got what I wished for, and now I don't know what to do. And
exactly.
And there's nothing more. It's more focusing, I guess, than just. Than just writing scared, you know, you know, you have to, you know, the days of waiting to be motivated or be inspired, you know, by events or whatever, you know, and having the perfect writing setting that I used to think I needed just evaporated. And it's like, I'm a professional now. I have to sit down on that TV tray and that footstool and I have to work. And
Absolutely.
It changes
yep.
a lot of things, but it does work. And you know, when you finally figure out how to do it, it's very gratifying. I can tell you, as somebody who used to fly jet airplanes and loved the challenge and the thrill of that, writing a book is every bit of that and maybe a little more.
Sure.
And it's, you know, it's addictive. And speaking of first moments, was there ever a moment when you got surprised? You got like a fan letter or recognized, or people knew you from that you were a novelist?
I think it's the first time seeing the book up on Amazon. Was one of those
oh, yeah.
those moments.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, the shock. And then after the release date comes, you know, this is terrible, but I think we all probably do it. You know, you go back there every day or every couple hours, and you're looking to see, like, who left you reviews and and how are they? What are they thinking? And these are truly people who don't love you, right? They don't even know you, so they can't even love you. And this is their opinion of your work, and you've put all this time and effort and energy into it. And so it hurts. You get those, you know, that critical review, and you're like, wow, they didn't get it, and you know, what could I have done to make them get it? Or you get the great reviews, and you're like, that's exactly what I was going for there.
How have you reacted to? Because there's and every author does this. We all deny it. It's to somebody, mm-hmm. but we all read those reviews, and
oh yeah,
and then there's the institutional reviews. There's the big guys. There's Publishers Weekly.
Sure.
There's, you know, those book lists. Those reviews come out, and they can sometimes sting a little bit. What? How do you react to that? Everybody has a system, I think.
Yeah, my wife hears me vent for, you know, when I get a bad one, and then she just tells me to get over it. That, you know, she always says something like, well, not everybody's going to love you, just get over it. And she's right, of course. And it's hilarious because that's exactly what we tell our children when they're acting up. So she's just turning around and echoing it to me.
Right.
But, yeah, that's pretty much it. You've got to understand that you're not writing for everybody, right? And not everybody who's going to pick up your work is going to be enthralled with it.
Right.
You know, for instance, I got some interesting hate mail early on. Hate mail is probably a strong term, but I had a few historians who were very upset that I altered history. And they just couldn't latch on to the fact that it was fiction. And it was supposed to be fun, right? I mean, this is an escape. It's something to maybe make you think about how things could have turned out differently if Lincoln had lived. They were really hung up on the fact that I let Lincoln live, and this was a terrible thing to have done. And, you know, I got into a discussion with one of them just back and forth on email, and I said, didn't you see the word novel on the front? He's like, yes, I know, but Lincoln died. And I said, yeah, I understand Lincoln died. I got that. But what I was actually trying to do is, you know, right this historical wrong and let Lincoln live to see the joining of the Union back together. And he just couldn't get over that. You know, that portion. So obviously he's not going to be in my fan base. And, he admitted at the end, he didn't read a lot of fiction. He picked up the book when a friend had told him about it so he could read it. And he just couldn't get over for that portion. So,
well,
I think you got to
realize, you know, I do the same.
You know, right in front of
that. And that's the great thing about Lincoln's Bodyguard is that you're right. It is a great hook. And like I said, you hooked me that night in San Diego, and I had to read this story. And then I was surprised. I was surprised what you did in a great way. 'Cause, you know, I, as a novelist, you get how stuff works. And so to be utterly surprised by somebody else's work is such a pleasant surprise. And I was with what you did in that book and the parallels to Jefferson and it was great. But I could see how some people could get their feathers ruffled. And I find that the people that bother to complain to me about stuff are people that are, they probably shouldn't have had the book in the first place. And it wasn't written for them and they're never going to like it. So, and that's going to happen, but you do have to put yourself out there. You know, my rule finally, and I'm getting better, but if I get a bad review, I try to, especially like an institutional review.
Sure.
I let myself pout and be a baby about it for 24 hours, and then I have to stop.
May I interrupt your lovely conversation for a second and just ask a couple questions of both of you? I'm so enjoying hearing these two brilliant authors speak to each other. What a delight. You both write such different kind of fiction, and it couldn't be polar opposite any more than they are. May I ask you, TJ, first, what do you think the role of fiction is in culture today? Particularly your brand of fiction. You write historicals with a twist, you're obviously having this great conversation about twisting the truth to work for your story. How important is fiction today?
That's a fantastic question. I think it's very important. I think it's something that can introduce someone to a brand new world, right? And if it's historical fiction like I write, maybe that interests them in, you know, what happened back then, and picking up a non-fiction book on the accounts. For instance, in Land of Wolves, my second book, the whole second half moves out west into the Lakota territories. It deals with essentially the Sioux Wars between the Lakota Indian tribes and the U.S. government, and
yes.
And I change history there too on the outcome. So probably not too much of a spoiler to say that, since I write revisionist historicals here, but I do so in such a way that's a little bit more favorable than the outcome that we actually had happen. So in a case like that, I guess my answer would be I would hope that it would make people think of, what could have been, and go back and look at some of the root cause of the problems that we still have today. There's still a lot of things from the Civil War that permeate into our culture that have, set up the institutions that we see that are so pervasive. So, I think it's just a role of helping people get introduced to things, to question why they are the way they are, and what can you do today to make the world a better place, maybe.
It's a really interesting answer. You know, Phil, you and I have spoken before, and we've talked about kind of your gypsy lifestyle. I don't know if most listeners remember, but you're kind of like a Rolling Stone. You've been a world traveler. You were a corporate pilot. You're a jet pilot. You've gone a lot of places and seen a lot of things. How do you think that all of your traveling and your experiences and the things that you love to do affect your writing? What role do our personal experiences play if we're writing a fiction story?
Well, I think they can play a huge part, depending on how brave you are.
Interesting.
I think one of the hardest things to do as a writer is to be fearless and to dig down deep and find out what it is that you really do have to say. And then if you can embellish that with a sense of place, I think every novel needs to have an interesting sense of place, and it as almost a background character. And in all my travels, I've been able to incorporate a lot of different places that I've actually stood on the street corner, and I've smelled the air, and I've tasted the food, and I don't know if that comes across all the time, but it gives me the confidence to do it.
How great.
So if I'm going to
You've walked
I'm gonna write
in your character's footsteps, in other words. You've taken a stroll the places where your characters are. John Irving is a big fan of doing that. I think it's magnificent. TJ, let me ask you this. Do you think that your service to our country, your role in the military, plays a big part of who you are as a writer of revisionist historical fiction?
I think it does. Yeah, it's certainly my love of American history kind of is fostered by my time in the service. So that's a portion of it. But then again, I think it's for me looking back on the things in the past, and in both my books, I've wanted to kind of right those historical wrongs, and there definitely is a very culturally oriented, piece of integrity inside the military, right, that they instill in us. And, so I look back on some of these wrongs and I want to be able to write them. So that usually comes into some of my stories. So I think it does.
I love
it
your Land
does,
of Wolves, by the way. Land of Wolves to me was, and I'm not a historical reader at all, but it was fascinating to me because I'm fascinated with indigenous peoples. And I like your spin on things. So congratulations on a job well done. It was magnificent.
Oh, thank you.
My pleasure. Matt, Philip, where can listeners and readers find you on the web, please?
Was that pointed at me?
But Phil, yes.
Oh, I'm on Amazon. I'm on Goodreads. I have a website, www.philipdonnelly.com. I do read all of the email that comes through there, so feel free to give a shout. I'm on Facebook, and I'm on Twitter. So I'm pretty much... everywhere.
You're out there. And I have to tell you, Phil has a beautiful, beautiful website, so please go by and take a look at it. It's got a really, just some really interesting history in there. I think you'll enjoy reading it. TJ, where can listeners and readers find you?
It almost identically in the same places. So I've Facebook and Twitter, as well as Goodreads and on Amazon. And my website is www.tjturnerauthor.com.
So my question to both of you is, before we wrap, we have a country in turmoil right now, kind of torn apart at the seams, and it's been like that for a little while. Will fiction help, or will fiction, or should we be reading nonfiction? Phil, what do you think?
I think, at least in my view, and it's the reason I write, is it's an escape. It's entertainment.
Yeah.
Thrillers,
yeah,
are. I'm not standing on a pulpit. At the very most, I am pulling aside the curtain, at least in my small way, and giving readers kind of an inside look at what it's like to maybe be in the cockpit of a jet, that there is espionage going on out there, that there's natural disasters that we can think about a little bit. But I don't hold to any higher ground than that, in that
it's
reading
pretty high.
A book is still the cheapest escape.
It's pretty high. TJ, I first of all want to thank you for your service. I know you just returned from Afghanistan, and regardless of what your role is, thank you so much. How important right now is it that people read and read fiction in this fractured country that we have right now? I think that, and I want to just qualify that by saying, I think one-to-one, people on both sides of the aisle find commonality. I think in the big picture, kind of like in the mob mentality, we don't. So how important is it in your worldview for us to read fiction?
To me, I agree with everything Phil said. I think it's very important. It can, just as you said, be a great escape, right? So that you've got all these troubles that are pressuring in. Depending on which news outlet you prefer to read, there's, you know, calamity is just around the corner, and it's going to turn out terrible.
Right.
You know, reading fiction, I think, to me, is a great way to escape. You do get introduced to other worlds. I love reading, you know, historical fiction, obviously, and even nonfiction about, you know, from the past. And you realize when you're transported to some of these other times and places that, you know, they had their same troubles came back then as we have now. They may appear a little bit different.
Yes.
They didn't have the internet and Twitter and social media to make it, you know,
they
the
didn't
24-hour
have media.
Bombardment.
Exactly. Yes.
But, you know, the media is so important, and at the same time, you need a break from it too, right? It's, you know, it's in order for the government to be completely transparent so people know what's going on in the world. But at the same time, you need to be able to step back and not get so carried away that you're carrying the weight of the world on your shoulders because of all these problems. So
what a great way to put it, too. Absolutely.
Kick back, lay back in the hammock,
I have
and have
to
some
say,
fun.
TJ Turner and Philip Donnelly, this has been one of my favorite in conversation interviews ever. You both are brilliant, and I cannot thank you enough for being with me tonight. TJ, you're up next with your choice of guest. You will get in touch with me. You know how to find me. And I hope you both have a wonderful weekend. Congratulations on the success of your fabulous books. I'm overwhelmed with joy and gratitude that you decided to join me tonight. Thank you so much. And I want to thank also listeners and readers for being here tonight. I hope you all have a great weekend. Thank you for being here. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night, all.
Thanks, Pam. Thanks, DJ.
Thanks, Pam.